Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Weavecast, Double Decker Weaving. Today's episode is all about double weave. Double weave encompasses a variety of techniques. There's weaving double width, there are double layers, there's quilted cloth, and double weave pickup patterning. Basically, it's any time you weave two or more layers of cloth at the same time, and usually those layers interact in some way. In the spirit of double weaving, we're going to have two interviews today. One is Jennifer Moore, a fabulous weaver who specialized in double weave pickup. And then we're also going to talk to Miranda Hoffman, who is the managing partner of Lakeside Fibers in Madison, Wisconsin. In other news, you can now send me an audio comment. If you have a weaving tip or a comment about the show that you'd like to send me, you can go to the Weavecast webpage at www.weavecast.com and look on the right-hand side, right under the links you use to subscribe to Weavecast, is a link that says leave an audio comment. I tried it out and it is easy and fun. All you need is a microphone. The cheap little microphone that came with your computer will be just fine. And I'd love to hear from you. One of the exciting things about doing Weavecast is getting user comments. It would be fun to hear your voice. And to get the ball rolling with the audio comments, I'm planning a Halloween Weavecast with a bunch of information about slaying the reed. So if you have a really great slaying tip, something that makes it go faster, more error-proof, perhaps a review of an auto slayer tool, or a description of your favorite slay hook, please do use that audio comment link on the webpage. Or if you don't have a microphone, please email me your slaying tips for that Halloween episode. Another way to find out more about what's going on in the weaving culture is WeaveRing. This is a web ring that was started a couple of years ago that specializes in weavers' blogs. And the way a web ring works, if you're not already familiar with the concept, is you create a master list of a whole bunch of websites that are all following the same topic. And then each of those websites puts a little icon, in this case, a really cute shuttle, somewhere on their page. And that icon also has back and next buttons, so you can browse randomly through a whole host of weaving blogs, or you can go up to the list and see the complete list. It's a great way to find out what other people are weaving and to see some of their work on the web. It's really fun. And speaking of work on the web, I'd like to thank everybody who's put pictures up on the Frapper map of the work they're doing. It's wonderful. It's fun to see what everybody is working on. In my guild, we have something called Hot Off the Loom, where people show up and display their goods that they've recently created. And it's kind of like a virtual Hot Off the Loom. So thank you, everyone who's participated in that. On a more personal note, I'd like to thank Brenda Dane of Cast On for the beautiful wool she sent me from the Wool Fest in Wales. In addition to building a deck this summer, I'm also doing a remodel to create a weaving studio in one of the front rooms of my home. The upshot of this is that all of my weaving equipment and all of my yarn are locked away in the garage in huge impenetrable piles, so I haven't been able to get my fiber fix. And this package from Wales came on a day when I was especially hard up for a fiber fix, so thank you, Brenda. Coming up next, we have Swatch of the Day, in which I describe weaving a double-width piece of cloth for a vest. One thing I've learned, if I'm gonna crash and burn, I'll do it on my terms, then make one beautiful mistake with you. Today's swatch is a piece of lofty, soft woolen fabric that I wove to make a vest. And here's the challenge. My baby wolf loom will weave a maximum of 26 inches wide. And we all know that's going to shrink after it comes off the loom. So maybe I can get 24 inches wide after everything's been fulled. So in order to make this vest, I decided that I would weave the cloth double width. And this is a really cool weaver's trick in which you weave a top layer of fabric and then kind of go around the corner and weave the bottom layer of fabric and then go back across the bottom, up, back to the top layer of fabric. So you're basically weaving two layers of fabric in a C, so they're connected at one side, say the left side. And then when you cut the fabric off the loom, if you've woven everything correctly and haven't inadvertently tied the layers together, you can open your C of fabric and it'll be twice as wide as you're weaving with. Isn't that fabulous? The only downside is you need twice as many shafts as you normally would because you're weaving two layers of fabric at once. So if you're weaving plain weave, you need a minimum of four shafts because that's two shafts for the top and two shafts for the bottom. If you're weaving a four shaft twill, you'd need eight shafts because you need four shafts for the top layer and four shafts for the bottom layer. It's a very fun technique. I encourage you to check it out. There are a lot of really good books written about double weave. And any basic weaving book like Learning to Weave by Debbie Chandler has this information. The yarn I used was Harrisville Highland Weight. I wanted the fabric to be light and lofty, so I wanted it set at 8 ends per inch. But of course, since I was weaving double width and I was weaving two layers, I actually slayed it at 16 ends per inch. And the wool I used, I had gotten secondhand, and so it was a large collection of very inexpensive to me wool in colors that I wouldn't have necessarily chosen. There was a lot of aubergine, which is kind of this reddish purplish color that didn't particularly float my boat, and just a host of other colors, you know, greens and browns and taupes, lots of taupe. And I had originally thought that I would over-dye everything. And I did over-dye a lot of the taupes into a mint green that I'm going to use for a blanket one day. But the other colors, these darker colors that couldn't be turned into any variation of mint green, went into this vest. And what surprised me is that aubergine really works well with a variety of colors. I had like hot pinks and purples, and it just drew everything in together. It was the yarn I also used as the weft, because I had so much of it, that it really tied things together nicely. And so it was a surprise to me that sometimes bad colors or colors that you wouldn't expect to work because of the way weaving blends colors together actually work. So sample, you never know what's going to happen when warp hits weft. When I was slaying this, not only did I have to slay it 16 inch per inch, but the last inch of the fold, I slayed looser than the base fabric. And the reason I did this is because we all know that selvages, just from the physics of the loom, have a tendency to draw in. Didn't want to use a temple. I didn't want there to be a ridge of denser fabric down the middle of my back when I made the vest. I found slaying that folded over part that you're going to weave, like if you're going to weave where the fold is on the left side, slaying those left inch worth of warps to half the set worked really well. In fact, when I opened up this cloth, it was very hard to tell where the fold had been, which of course is, you know, exactly what you want. This project went amazingly well. I am very happy with wool as a very forgiving medium. You can make a lot of mistakes and wool will just kind of squish around and you can full it and hide a lot of mistakes. The project went very well. I pulled it off. I had been incredibly obsessive about the treadling because if you make a mistake in double width weaving, you can actually tie your cloth together. So instead of unfolding, you get this interested sort of quilted together amalgam. But in this case, that didn't happen. I was able to unfold it, zigzag the ends with machine stitch, and then I threw it in the washing machine and kind of hovered over it. I put it on hot water and agitate and a little bit of Dawn dishwashing liquid, which can lead to felting, which is why you hover it over it and you pull it out from time to time and look at it. And it fulled beautifully. And then I took a scrubby brush and scrubbed the surface so it kept lofty and so soft. And what was really interesting is that if you look at the Harrisville on the cones, it really doesn't feel that good. but that has some residue from the milling that makes it strong to warp. But when you wash it, that all comes out, and the yarn that was stretched under tension, because wool stretches so nicely, relaxes, and you get the really soft, drapeable fabric. So, very much like wool. That's the story of my double width vest material. If you have a loom with a small weaving width, don't despair. You can always weave double wide. That beautiful song was Moonlight Shimmers by Technetium from their album String Theory. I chose it for reasons that will become apparent as we talk to Jennifer Moore about her work. Jennifer Moore is a double weaver who specializes in a technique called double weave pickup. Now, in contrast to the double width weaving that I described during today's swatch, double weave pickup has two layers of fabric, usually in contrasting colors, and you can selectively pick up or push down warp threads as you're weaving to create graphic images. And it's a lot like creating images on a computer. If you think of each little dot where warp intersects weft as a pixel, you can make really intricate designs. And Jennifer Moore has made a career out of doing really beautiful things with double weave pickup. So let's talk to her about her inspirations and her current work.
Today I'm doing my very first telephone interview, so I'm very excited about that. And even more wonderful is the fact that with me is Jennifer Moore, who specializes in double weave and specifically double weave pickup. She's done some really amazing work and is one of my favorite weavers because I fell in love with a moon calendar done in beautiful rainbow colors on a black background. And for years that image stuck with me, and then one day I saw a workshop for a person doing double weave pickup, and lo and behold, it was the same instructor. So I've taken a workshop with her, and not only is she a great and talented weaver, but she's also a fine workshop instructor. So please help me welcome Jennifer Moore.
Thank you.
So I'm always curious, how did you get your start in hand weaving?
Well, I was a senior in college. This was in the late 1970s. And I was in my last probably 6 months of college. And I was working on a double major, a self-designed major in art and biology with a minor in pipe organ performance.
Well, that's really interesting. How did you come up with that combination?
Well, the art and biology went fairly smoothly together. I was basically planning to become a medical illustrator.
Ah.
But I also had a background in music and played the pipe organ all through college and just loved it. So it was kind of a sideline, but something that I did focus on a fair amount. My main focus in college as far as art was in drawing and painting and calligraphy. But I was also taking one of everything, basically, one class in each of the different media just to have some exposure to it. I signed up for a weaving class just because there was one. And I really didn't know anything about weaving. I didn't even really know what it was. But I signed up for the class, and the minute I sat down at a loom, I just felt completely at home. I immediately felt the similarity between weaving on the loom and playing the pipe organ.
I was going to say, I mean, that's got to be the perfect training for weaving.
It is. I mean, after you've played Bach fugues with your feet, you know, working the treadles is nothing. So, and that actually ended up being the germ, the seed of where a lot of my work has gone in the past almost 30 years now, because I became very intrigued with relationships between weaving and music. And that ended up becoming the focus of my graduate studies when I did my Master of Fine Arts in Weaving, and has continued to be since then.
It's very cool. I mean, weaving ties into math, and math, of course, ties into music, so I can see how there would be a juncture there.
Yes, and one leads into another, and the journey just keeps on going.
One of my stock questions for everyone I bring on this show was, what was your first loom?
Well, my first loom was given to me by an older weaver who kind of took me under her wing. And she gave me an old table loom that she wasn't using, and it had a shed of about a quarter of an inch. It was very difficult to weave on, but it gave me the ability to weave at home anytime I wanted instead of having to go to a class. So that was great. And then maybe 2 or 3 years later, I acquired my first grown-up loom, which I still have to this day, and it's an 8-harness Gilmore loom.
Oh, I've heard good things about the Gilmores.
They're wonderful. It's a real workhorse and just a very logical, no bells, no whistles loom that works wonderfully. And now I work on a big 16-harness AVL CompuJobby most of the time. But I still have my 8-harness Gilmore, and I feel like I'll probably have it for the rest of my life.
I know what you mean. I've, on occasion, tried to sell my first loom, which was a 4-shaft Baby Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
But I wove on it while I was in labor with my son. And so it's like, it's part of the family history.
Absolutely.
I would be so sad if I actually did sell it.
Yeah.
So, how did you end up specializing in double weave?
Well, I actually started doing double weave fairly early on. I guess I had been weaving for maybe 2 or 3 years before I started working in double weave. But I actually learned about double weave pretty much after I started weaving right away, because my first teacher, whose name was Judith Poxon Fox, was doing double weave at that time fairly extensively. And I didn't really understand what it was, other than that there was some magical way of weaving 2 separate layers of cloth at the same time, and that you could also interchange the 2 layers. And the idea of this really appealed to me, because right away when I became a weaver, I felt like I wanted to be able to break away from selvage to selvage weaving and having one color go all the way across the weaving.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I love the interaction of warp and weft colors and the blending of color that you get with those. So I tried out tapestry for a while because you can get the specific areas of design that you want, but you're really just working with the weft colors. And so double weave and double weave pickup in particular gives me the ability to have complete control over design areas, but at the same time, the wonderful color blending that you get with the crossing of warp and weft colors.
And you have a really wonderful color sense. Looking at your works, you bring a lot of colors together and they flow harmoniously, and you bring in colors that I wouldn't have necessarily thought, but they work beautifully. How did you develop that color sense?
I think it's kind of developed along with me as a weaver. I really never worked in color before I became a weaver. I worked mostly in black and white.
So even in your art training, you didn't do a lot of work with color?
No, I didn't. I did some. I did some, but I was not that comfortable with color. And most of my work was drawing, black and white drawing, which I love to do. But in weaving, you work very differently with color than you do in paint. And you're working with, you know, specific colors of yarn and then blending those together optically in the mixtures. And for some reason, this just instantly felt very comfortable to me. And when I did my first double weave piece, my image was to have a solid black layer as one of my layers, and then a multicolored layer, basically a spectrum of colors that played off against the black. And that is what I did and still do quite a lot of to this day. And as I've gone along in the years, I've been doing double weave for over 20 years now. My color sense, I think, has become more refined in the process and more sophisticated, but I still work very much in that same way of working out a spectrum of colors to work with against a neutral background.
I like the work you've done with the black and the spectrum, because the black really intensifies
the
color blending. As I said in the intro, one of my favorite pieces of yours is the 2000 Moons piece. Would you care to describe that and tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind it?
Sure. That is a very special piece. I find that about once a decade, a really magical piece comes into my life, and that was one of them, where I almost feel like I'm not the one doing it, but I'm almost spoken through, and the channel ends up creating the piece. I put a warp on my loom. It was a double weave warp with a black layer, and then the other layer was a space-dyed silk in a fairly intense spectrum of colors. And this is really unusual for me. I usually have my design completely planned out, all worked out on graph paper to the thread. But in this case, I just set up the warp on the loom without having a plan in mind. And I laid out the space-dyed warp on a diagonal so that the colors moved on an angle rather than straight across. It up on my loom, and for some reason I looked at it and I got an image of a moon calendar where you basically see all of the moons of the year laid out as they fall throughout the year, and the full moons do fall on a diagonal as they move through the month. So I thought, well, I need to find a copy of the moon calendar. And this was in the year 2000. As it happened, the next day I went to an acupuncture appointment, and I walked into the office, and there was a moon calendar on the wall.
Wow.
I said, wow, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Could I possibly make a copy of that? And she said, well, I actually happen to have a spare one here.
Wow, so it really was kismet.
So I did, and I took it home. It absolutely perfectly aligned with the way that I had the warp lined up on the loom. I could not possibly have planned it any better than it worked out. Then I had to graph out each of the phases of the moon, basically count threads and pick them up for each individual moon in the year. It took me basically a full year to weave this, I had a lot of really magical experiences in the process of doing that. I wove it mostly at night when the moon was shining, and had the experience one night of weaving in the middle of the night and realizing that the full moon was shining through my window on me, and it was the exact moon that I was weaving at that moment.
How beautiful.
Yeah. So it's been a very special piece.
Well, I know that since then you've done some more work bringing weaving and music together. You've actually done a piece that's in an orchestra lobby and was set to music. How did that come about?
Well, that was actually sort of the cornerstone of my thesis work when I did my Master of Fine Arts. When I went back to graduate school and had to choose an area to focus on for my thesis work, I decided that was the time to really go into depth into the relationships between weaving and music. Music is very mathematical and has a strong underlying structure to it. So I decided to study the mathematical structures in music as a starting point. I studied the music of Johann Sebastian Bach in quite a bit of depth.
Now, why did you pick Bach?
Well, because, of course, as an organ student, he's the Grand Master, and he was my favorite composer to play. But he also worked very mathematically in his work, and very consciously mathematically, and incorporated a lot of musical symbolism into his work. So I was very fascinated with that. And I read a lot about him and his work, as well as the geometry behind music. And I learned about the whole field of sacred geometry in the process, which is very much built upon the proportions that are found in music.
So when you say sacred geometry, are you talking about the Fibonacci series?
The Fibonacci series very closely ties in with the golden proportion, which is very much an integral part of sacred geometry. It's a proportion that is found everywhere in nature, and you can almost think of it as being sort of a blueprint for the creation of the universe.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I was studying Bach's music and his life, and I noticed that I was thinking a lot about a piece of his that I read about called The Chromatic Fantasy. And I thought about the title and realized that the word chromatic has a double meaning. It has a visual meaning and a musical meaning. And visually, chromatic refers to color. And in music, it refers to the chromatic scale, which it uses both the half tones and whole tones in a scale. So it has a wider range of tones than the diatonic scale that we're accustomed to using in Western music. And I was really interested in this correlation between these two meanings of the word chromatic and decided to weave a chromatic fantasy.
Cool.
And so I listened to the music. It's a piece that Bach wrote for the harpsichord. And I listened to it over and over and over and just let imagery come to me as I listened to it and worked out a series of weavings based on this. And this was a project, another one of those really magical projects where it started out innocently enough and then just grew and grew and grew. And it ended up turning into a series of 5 panels that all fit together to create one large composition.
How big are the panels?
Well, the individual panels are about 3 feet wide by 4 feet high.
Wow.
So the whole piece, when it's put together, is about 14 feet across. After I finished weaving them, I was playing around with the order in which I arranged them and trying out different ways of arranging them and flipping some of the panels upside down. And I discovered that no matter how I arranged it, they would fit together to create a composition. So then I worked out the mathematical formula for how many possible ways I could arrange these 5 pieces in a line, expecting it to be something like 20 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be 3,280 different ways that the piece can be arranged.
Yeah, wow.
So so that led into the next project, which was I took photographs of the pieces and made many, many color copies of it and cut apart the five individual pieces. And then I could play around with it on a table and move them around and try out different arrangements. And that led to the idea to create a flip book where I took the images, which I mounted on cardstock, and made stacks of them. So I had 10 stacks of the images, and there's 10 possible images because there's five original weavings, and each one can be rotated 180 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So with this arrangement of 10 images each in 10 different stacks that are hinged, there are 10 billion possibilities that you can make with this flip book.
I've played with that book. It's really mesmerizing. You sit there and you flip the colors back and forth and create new patterns.
Yeah, it's really fun.
And then you animated it, right?
Yes, I did. Then that led to the next thing, which was that I made a computer animated video of those images of the weavings dancing to the music of Bach that inspired them in the first place.
It may be the first ever weaving music video.
Possibly. I don't know. But I basically recorded the music into the computer, which digitized it, and showed it on the screen as a wavelength pattern so I could see visually what the music was doing and plan out where I wanted movement in the visuals to happen. And then I scanned the images of the weavings into the computer, and using an animation program, I could then place the images on the screen in different positions and time them to line up with the changes in the music.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So where does this piece live now if somebody wanted to go view it?
This piece now lives in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, in the Alberta Kimball Auditorium. And they have the series of weavings up on the wall in the lobby as you enter the building. I've actually never been there in person, but I've seen pictures of it. And I understand that they have a copy of the flipbook on a pedestal by the weavings, and that they also occasionally screen the video before performances.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on now? What are your current inspirations?
Well, I started to talk a little bit about the sacred geometry, and it seems to be having a rather large resurgence in my life at the moment. About 2 years ago, I was commissioned by a rug company in North Carolina called Cable Rugs to design a series of rugs for them using the geometry that I work with. And so I did a series of about 10 or 12 designs for them. And these are rugs that are being woven in India. They're hand-knotted rugs. And so I pulled out a lot of the sources that I work with from many different cultures using the geometry to create a series of rugs for them. And in the process, really got very much back into working with this design mode. And so that has led into a lot of inspiration for new pieces that I'm weaving now. And I also suddenly am getting a lot of interest in teaching design workshops using these ideas.
Right, I saw that you had a new workshop based on the sacred geometry.
Yes, I do. I actually just finished teaching the first one in Santa Barbara, California, and I've scheduled about five or six more for the remainder of this year.
So what do you talk about in that workshop? If somebody wanted to take it, what would they be getting out of it?
Well, this workshop, it's not specifically geared necessarily towards weaving. It can be for anybody working in any medium. And so it's a design workshop rather than a weaving workshop. And we work with the ideas of sacred geometry, doing basic constructions with a compass and a straight edge to design geometric shapes. We work a lot with symmetry patterns, and we make rubber stamps to explore different symmetry ideas. And we also go into tessellations, which are tiling patterns, and how you go about generating those and working with those in design. This is a very visually based workshop rather than a numbers and formulas based workshop.
Okay, so no graduate degree required.
It's very non-intimidating for people who are not comfortable with working with math.
Right.
So I've been very involved in reading, trying out different ideas, developing ideas of projects to do in these designs or in these workshops. The next one that I teach is actually for a book arts group here in Santa Fe. And so I'm developing ideas for things that we can do three-dimensionally with this, because I think that'll apply very well to people creating books. I'm actually very excited. I just learned yesterday that I've been accepted to present a paper on my thesis project, the Chromatic Fantasy Project, at a conference called Bridges, which is about mathematics in art, music, and science.
Oh,
that
wonderful.
Is going to be held in London this August.
London, very nice.
Yeah.
So you're an internationally renowned weaver now.
Well, I'm working on it.
Well, I've really enjoyed our talk. It's been great having you on the show. And
thank you.
It sounds like you're very busy, so I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to chat with us.
Well, it's great to talk with you. I appreciate you having me on.
That was Detective Double Bass by Last Future. Coming up next, we have an interview with Miranda Hoffman, managing partner of Lakeside Fibers in Madison, Wisconsin. And my mother lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Whenever I visit her, I always make a special side trip to Lakeside Fibers. There are very few weaving retail stores in the world. And Lakeside Fibers has had to cut back on their weaving a little bit and cater to the knitters. But there's still a lot of great stuff there. They've moved us into the basement, but they have some interesting, beautiful looms and some wonderful fibers, and it's well worth a trip if you're in the area. So let's talk to Miranda and see what she says.
So do you personally weave?
I do.
What is your favorite loom?
My favorite loom is the Louette David, 36-inch, 8-shaft. I have one in Natural Cherry, which is what we have a worldwide exclusive with that. We had Louette make them for us in Cherry.
Please tell me you're going to keep stocking weaving stuff.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a lot of things to choose from, and unfortunately, the weaving has trailed off a little bit. It's very difficult because I think the internet has really hurt the local weaving store. We haven't seen as much of an impact on the knitting business because knitting, they see the yarn, they buy it, they want to take it home. With weaving, people need such a volume of yarn, they're willing to have it shipped in because it's cheap.
I'm going to put in a plug for the local weaving store because one thing you don't get off the internet is the rich depth of color because monitors can't reproduce it correctly. And
the service.
Yeah, I came in here a couple of years ago looking for yarns to do my COE, Certificate of Excellent Hand Weaving, and I'd been trying to make the color wheel, and it was just so much fun to pull the 10-2 cotton off your shelf and build the color wheel right there and purchase it and know that the colors were going to be great.
Right, and we do wind off by the ounce for people, and, we just do stress that service, and that is, unfortunately, that extra quarter per ounce that you pay here is the fact that you can walk in off the street and look at it, and so when you, the catalog business, you don't get that.
Right.
And that's why when you're purchasing things locally, that's what you're getting.
So. Yeah, and you support great weaving stores, so you can go in and touch the fibers
exactly.
And see the yarns and play with the looms. And
great.
Yeah, no, we have one in Seattle called Weaving Works.
Yes, that's a great shop.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, when I'm in Seattle, I go to Weaving Works. When I'm here, I always tell my mom, I'm coming to Madison. I got to get the Lakeside Fibers.
Yeah, and we do mail order as well. A lot of times what'll happen is someone was in town and they bought something and they can't remember what it was. And so we'll get a snippet and they're like, oh, I need more of this. And we will gladly wind off ounces of mail. But we don't do volume discounts through the mail.
Then you'd be a mail order place.
Right, and I'm maybe cutting the throat of someone in Washington, and I don't want to do that.
When I was here a couple of years ago, your staff was amazing. Because I wanted 13 colors of 10-2 cotton, and I wanted 3 ounces each, which if you've ever went off 13 balls of 3 ounces of 10...
262 yards
yes.
an ounce. Yep.
But they were very friendly and professional. And then later, I realized I hadn't documented what color, so I was one of those people who sent you the little thing of snippets going, help! Because I needed the documentation for the COE. So bless your staff. Yep. They are really good people.
Well, thank you.
And there are definite benefits to being able to touch the fibers. And I love, come in here, I can get small amounts with the wind off and do a sample, and then I know my fabric is going to be good.
Mm-hmm. And you can bring back your project when, if it didn't work properly, and say, what did I do?
Yes.
Why didn't this work? And I can say, well, you probably should have set it tighter or looser or whatever, and we can do that. And we're more than willing to do that with people. And we have, you know, that's an extra level of service that a local shop, no matter what, whether it's your hardware store, your yarn store,
right,
bakery, or what have you, offers you that a lot of national.
Like if you go to Michael's Arts and Crafts and you ask them to help you with your weaving project, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
So, are most of your staff here knitters and weavers?
We have 3 weavers on staff, and then the rest of our staff is knitters. But most of the time, I'm here, and then on weekends, Patrick or one of our other weavers is here.
When I look at where guilds are on the map, there's a lot in the Pacific Northwest where I'm from, and I notice that there's a lot of activity around Madison.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the Madison Fiber Arts community?
We do have a very active Fiber Arts community. Our Knitters Guild is in the thousands. We also do have a Weavers Guild that is active. There is also the Wisconsin Hand Weavers Guild out of Milwaukee, and they have, I think, over 1,000 members that statewide people will drive down. They meet once a month. And people will drive down from northern Wisconsin to go to Weaving Guild.
So are there 1,000 people in a room at the meetings?
No, usually not. But they, okay. You know, again, it's at supporting. You know, people will pay their dues and say they're members. And they have a really great newsletter. You get a little sample. You get a drawdown and a little, you know, square inch of a fabric that's woven by a volunteer member.
Oh,
and they
cut
them all up and mail them in your mailing. So a lot of people are members because of that. And then they exhibit at the state fair, and they bring in teachers and things like that. So they have a very active guild. And then there's also the North Shore Weavers Guild. And then we have Seavers School up on Washington Island.
Oh.
They teach weaving, which is up in northern Wisconsin. And I think it's probably because we have originally a large influx of Scandinavian people. You know, the Minnesota Weavers Guild on Minneapolis is very active. And I think it is just because we do have a number of people that settled here. We're Scandinavian and German, and those are very strong woven traditions.
Right.
So we also sell a lot of Dale in Norway here too,
Yes.
So it is, that may be part of it. In addition to the fact that it's either winter for 9 months and then it's summer for 3 months. It's either really hot or really cold here, and it's really cold here longer than it's hot. So I think you're inside more, which comes back to that, what am I going to do for 9 months in here? So you either knit, you weave, you know, a lot of people do a lot of handwork in this part of the world because it's so cold. And those are our table looms we use for classes.
Oh, so you teach classes.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of classes do you teach?
We do have a strong beginning weaving class, and then we also do, usually our next level is like an intermediate kind of independent study that we do for a couple weeks with people that are going beyond that. We do occasionally bring teachers in. I also teach at Oakwood, the local retirement village, which is fun. 90-year-old women that have never woven in their lives that are making double weave projects, which is
cool.
Really kind of neat. And that's wonderful to see them get excited about it.
Now, I noticed that you have a lot of fine threads in here, which I think is wonderful because I sometimes have a hard time finding fine threads. And you carry, like, almost all the colors or many of the colors of UKI.
Yeah,
and
close.
In this area, is there a lot of fine thread weaving?
We usually start out, for beginners, we'll start them on something on 3-2 and then move them into 5 or 10-2. Most of what we sell is either 5 or 10-2. But then a lot of our thicker stuff is upstairs with the knitting stuff. But we also have a lot of knitters that use 3-2 cotton for like dishcloths and
stuff. Sure.
Because Zephyr Silk and Wool is a very, very popular cross fiber. Knitters use it and the weavers use it.
Do you carry the Zephyr in cones?
Yes, we do.
Ah. So if you're in the Madison, Wisconsin area, please do trek on down to Lakeside Fibers. Not only do they have beautiful yarns and some yarns that I haven't seen around, but they also have an amazing store. The upper level opens out to a view of the lake and when...
4,000 square feet.
4,000 square feet. Wow. And they have a coffee bar, and you can look for knitting yarns and woolens upstairs and come downstairs for cottons and rayon chenilles and zephyr on the cone and just
tinsel silk.
Oh, and weaving books.
And warp.
Ooh, and Maysville cotton warp.
Yep.
Ah. And they have a very cute website. Yes, yes. I told my mom to just drop me off and come back when you close. I thought I'd get this out of the way first. But yes, do support your local weaving store and make a trip to Lakeside if you're in the Madison area. Lovely, lovely store and wonderful staff. And thank you so much for the interview.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you very much.
She's always a picture you didn't know you'd get. Today it's her cleavage in an off-the-shoulder dress that's a little more than tight but fit nice in 85. Now follow her, please, to a booth by the window. She drops menus on the table like a bad relationship. She used to like small talk, but she's gotten over it. And she's so very tired, see, quitting time's unclear, 'cause this summer job has lasted 27 years. And now sometimes she likes making the new girls cry. And yes, sometimes she walks slower if you're stuck behind. Yeah, it's just so
slower, 'cause she's just so far behind.
Yeah, it's just so deep.
gorgeous song was Double Wide, performed by singer-songwriter Beth Thornley on her newest album, My Glass Eye. I found it while searching the PodSafe Music Network under the weaving term Double Wide, and although it had nothing to do with weaving, it was so beautifully written and performed that I just had to include it. I've gone up to Beth's website, and I found out that you can actually buy autographed copies of this CD. That is at www.beththornley.com. I'll also have a link to this on the main Weavecast page. Great new artist. I really am enjoying her work, and hope you are too. And now, today's audio essay, Double-Decker Weaving. Did you get a lot of weaving done this summer? I didn't. I spent most of my days outside in the sunshine working hard, constructing a new deck. Our old deck had survived 20 rain-soaked Pacific Northwest winters and had finally given up the ghost and rotted through. So it needed to be replaced. And happily, a royalty check came through for Eric, and so we had some funds to put towards this project, and we were discussing what to do about the deck. And I came up with this brilliant idea. Hey, why don't I design and build the deck, and then we can put all of the money towards materials. And this made me happy for a couple of reasons. One, because it sounded like a fun project, and I love taking on things I don't know how to do and learning how to do them. And secondly, I tend to fall into avocations that take up a lot of time, but don't provide much money, such as writing, weaving, podcasting, and the number one time-intensive, low-pay avocation, motherhood. So this seemed like a way I could give something back and contribute to the family in a real financial way. I would put my labor into the house. So while I was building the deck, and it took several months because it was my first deck and I hadn't constructed anything since I was 8 years old building a treehouse, and so I had to pause and consider things from time to time and rethink things. And there was a lot of time where I was hammering or pouring or moving pea gravel, doing relatively mindless jobs. And that gave me a lot of time to think about weaving. Because, of course, I couldn't weave during all this time, but I could think about weaving. And I learned that you could discover a lot about weaving from a deck. The first interesting thing about building a deck was announcing your intention to people. When I told my husband, hey, I'll design and build the deck, he got very quiet and he looked at me and he went, oh, you'll build the deck. And he's known me for 12 years. He's seen me accomplish quite a few unusual things, but this one blew past his buffers. He didn't say anything, but there was fear in his eyes. And then my friends, their reaction was, you're going to build a deck? You? And neighbors all agreed that it was quite an odd thing. I mean, even my feminist go hike in the Arctic for months and take pictures of polar bear neighbors looked at me and went, you'll build a deck? So like weaving, when you take up an esoteric practice like deck building, your friends and family may at first scoff. Now, I don't know if there are classes about how to build a deck. There probably are, and they're probably fabulous, but I did not know how to access those. So I trotted off to my local library and checked out a stack of books on deck building, and I pored through them and read them over and over again until it began to make some sort of sense. And I discovered that, like weaving, if you're on your own, books are your friend. I've learned a lot from books over the years. It's a wonderful way to get information if you don't have access to a weaving teacher. After I had my books and I had drawn up a plan I thought would basically work and bought some of the pressure-treated foundation lumber, I trotted off to my local rental place. because I needed to drill 6 holes that were 8 inch in diameter and 18 inches deep, and no way was I doing that with my post hole digger. So I went to the local rental place and I asked for a gas-powered auger. And this is a wonderful device. I asked for the one-person auger. It's huge. It's got a gas engine, and it's got a lever, and you grab the handle and you pull down in this huge auger that's like the 8-inch wide drill bit. You push that into the ground. It's very satisfying. And again, I got kind of, "You're going to build a deck?" from the people behind the counter, but they set me up. They helped me load up the gas auger and ship me off, and I just had a wonderful time. I drilled extra holes to plant a signpost out in front of my house with the street number, and to plant a mailbox next to my garden so I could store tools. I was like a gopher with this thing. And the weaving analogy is that when you start a new craft like weaving or deck building, you will need to buy or rent new equipment. After I got the footings poured, the next part was framing the foundation. This is huge timbers that are called posts and joists. And it's important that when you build your foundation that it be square, because the boards you're going to deck it with are square. And it would look funny if when you got up to the house, you know, there was a gap at one end. So there's a technique you use called squaring the corners. It makes use of the Pythagorean theorem. And there's a simplified version of, if one leg is 3 feet and another leg is 4 feet and the diagonal is 5, then you know the place you're measuring is square no matter what. But this process of getting the foundation perfectly level and perfectly square reminded me a lot of warping the loom, because mistakes I made in the preparation would affect the main work, whether it be laying the decking or weaving the cloth. So the lesson here was, be meticulous early on. Mistakes can snowball on you. So then it was time to purchase the decking. And I know about myself that I am a builder, not a maintainer, which means I will work extraordinarily hard to construct something from nothing, but I can't be bothered to restain a deck every year. I wanted to use composite lumber. It's a new type of decking material that uses recycled plastic and recycled sawdust to make this thing that looks like wood but wears a lot like plastic. It sheds water, it doesn't rot, wonderful stuff. And lo and behold, I went to my building supply place and they had tan composite decking on sale. And so I said, yippee! And I bought enough for my entire project and I took it home. So I think it's important to use the best materials you can afford. It's really hard to make an outstanding project using substandard materials. But then, after I got my decking home, I learned another important lesson. I looked at the tan decking, and it just didn't work in my surroundings. I live in a very saturated color environment. I have dark green evergreen trees. I have rich brown cedar, charcoal gray boulders. And this light tan color that would have been perfect in a desert or beach setting, completely at odds with my environment. So to my husband's and the building supplier's consternation, I decided that the thing to do was to return the shipment of decking I had bought on sale. And thank goodness they let me do it, because it really just would not have worked in any way, shape, or form. I spent weeks letting it sit there to see if the color would grow on me, and it just didn't. So what I did was I went back to the building supplier, and I picked out a tiny bit more expensive board that was a deep reddish brown that blended beautifully with the environment. Oddly enough, the lumber that I picked also had some color variations to make it look more like real wood. When they were forming the planks, they would also throw in some darker color and kind of swirl it so it looked like wood grain. And it was really funny when I got it home and I was moving around and I looked down and I went, oh my gosh, you know what I bought? I bought space-dyed lumber. It's true. But The weaving lesson I took away from this is that color is important. When you add a color to a warp, it's important that it work with the other colors. Right before I was going to lay the decking, I looked at my foundation, which I had carefully squared. And I had been very meticulous when I measured each joist. I would cut it off to exactly the right length, which was a mistake because, unbeknownst to me, the house actually bows outward in the middle. So although the deck as a whole was perfectly square, once I got everything put on and all the joists laid, I looked down along the front of my deck and it bowed out about an inch in the middle, and it was really noticeable and kind of heartbreaking because it was going to be a pain to take off the header board on the front and fix that. But it bothered me, and I had learned my lesson from the tan decking that a mistake that bothers me will not go away. It will continue to bother me. I think there are two types of crafters. There are the happy accident people. And these people, I think, have some intuitive sense that give them more happy accidents than I get. I am the, if it bugs me, I should just fix it. I spent years trying to convince myself I was the happy accident type of crafter because that just seemed like a much more fun way to live. But I've had to come to terms with my inner perfectionist and just realize that if a mistake bugs me, it's better for me to take the extra time, undo it, because it will just bug me forever if I don't. And time and again, when I have taken the extra time in a project, whether it's weaving or knitting, or in this case, that darn header board, it really makes me happy to see it right. So, what I had to do was I had to get an enormous jack and pry off the header board. And then I did what I should have done in the first place. And I stretched a line from one joist to the other joist because the two ones on the very outside were the same length. And the line has chalk on it and you lift up it and you snap a chalk line. And then you know you got a perfectly straight line because the shortest distance between any two points is a straight line. And there you go. So that really highlighted for me how off my joists were. And I was able to recut them and put the header back on. And it's much, much better now. So my weaving takeaway from that was fix mistakes now, not later. If I had tried to fix that mistake after I had laid the decking, it would have been a nightmare. So I was really glad that I fixed it, stopped, took the time, did it right. Then when I was laying decking, I had to cut holes in this somewhat fragile composite material. I mean, it's not brittle, but it's very flexible. And so I had to cut holes. And there was one place where I cut holes to go around the posts that we're going to hang the railing off of. And I was moving it into place, and the board just snapped. And my 20-foot long board suddenly became a 12 and 8-foot long board. And I sat down, and I was just demoralized. But the good news is I had been a weaver long enough that I knew an important, crucial thing that saved me at this juncture. Because composite decking comes in dye lots. But as a fiber artist, I knew what to do, and I had bought extra. So with dye lots, whether it be decking material or yarn, buy extra. Mistakes will happen. And it was a really good feeling to know that I could redo the board and use this extra chopped up one for steps or a bench later. Then, after I had got all the holes cut and all the decking kind of roughly laid out, it was time to screw the decking down. Composite decking really needs to be pre-drilled if you want to get a clean look without any mushrooming around the screw heads. So it was going to take me 1,292 screws to attach my decking to the joists. And because I had to pre-drill every hole first, that was 2,584 separate drilling operations. This is why my deck took months. But I thought of a lesson I had learned from Judith McKenzie when she talked about doing it under eternity, just focusing on the moment, because you had to focus on each screw you drilled in or it would strip on you. And I just focused, I relaxed, I didn't think about the 1,292 holes, and just did it one pre-drilled hole at a time. and it all got done. Then, after I got the decking laid and I was putting the railing up, I noticed that the prefab railing that I bought for this deck, the caps were a little bit concave, so when you put them on the post, there's a tiny sliver of a hollow there. And I came up with this idea that it would be fun to put a little time capsule in there, a little message about who I and my family were at this point in time, and why I decided to build the deck, and just a little hello to the future. And the weaving takeaway from this is, whatever you're doing, put a little bit of yourself in the project. Even if you're doing a project out of handwoven that you think is perfect as is, try to find a little finesse, a little something that makes it uniquely yours. I know for me that really adds to the satisfaction. And now that my deck is finished, it's like a gift. Whenever I look at it, it's this beautiful thing that's functional, strong, and just amazingly satisfying to know that that was something that started as a wild idea in my head and is now made real through my efforts. So I guess the takeaway for me there is enthusiasm for learning new things. Even if they're a bit out there, even if they're a bit esoteric or scary, or they seem really hard, enthusiasm for learning new things will carry you far, even if it's just as far as your backyard deck. Would you like to be on Weavecast? Please send your audio comments, audio essays, interviews, or, if you prefer, written essays to Syne, that's S-Y-N-E, at weavecast.com. Further information about how to format submissions is available on the web at www.weavecast.com. Weavecast is made possible through the generosity of its donating listeners. Thank you. You too can be a Weavecast sponsor. Simply go up to the site and select the Make a Donation link. We appreciate your support. I'd also like to thank the artists who share their musical talents on the PodSafe Music Network. Without you, this show would be a lot less rockin'. Finally, it's time to get warped, because everybody knows you have to be warped to weave.